How can we help?
I am a content specialist with a large database company, and I often run into the issue of the comprised of, composed of, consist of, and comprises issue with people who believe it should be comprised of, and sometimes a big debate breaks out. So I've kind of been beaten into submission in using composed, comprised of, but I wanted to see if we could discuss that issue, composed of versus comprised of, and, you know, how to use that word appropriately.
So tell us about the comprised of debate there.
So a typical sentence or a typical phrase in our very sexy industry of technology would be something like, they are building somewhat unwieldy multi-cloud environments comprised of SaaS or PaaS cloud offerings or mixes of public infrastructure as a service environment. I often try to use the pizza example, which I try to say to them, okay, comprise means to include or consist of, mm-hmm. like you would say the pie comprises 8 slices or 8 slices compose the pie, try and make it simple for people to understand. But it seems like most people just want to default to comprise of, but then when I insert the constitute or consists of, mm-hmm. it often sounds funny, you know, it doesn't fit in the sentence and it looks weird, but I've kind of just given up hope.
Oh,
so I just use comprised of, but I want to be able to explain to them or even send them a podcast of the show to say, hey, I'm not the only one who says this is incorrect in this instance, you know? So I was looking for guidance on how people keep it clear because it's very confusing, you know, the difference between comprise or when to use comprising or comprises. Do you ever use the comprise of or should you just go with compose as an alternative, you know, is composed of, you know, as an example?
Yeah. Well, Susanna, you'll be glad to know that technically you're right. Just don't say comprised of. Just don't. That's the traditional rule. The problem is that people like you and me sound sort of prissy now when we insist that that you shouldn't say comprised of. I mean, if you go back to the origin of this word, it's related to the word comprehend. It comes from Latin words that mean basically a wrap your arms around something. And your pizza example is a good one. I like talking about the alphabet, too. The alphabet comprises 26 letters. Or it's composed of 26 letters, or it consists of 26 letters. Yeah, but technically, traditionally, sticklers are going to say don't say comprised of. But
okay.
But what's but then what do you do with that information in your workplace?
Right. Well, now I show them that an authoritative source has agreed with me, and I play the podcast for everyone, and then everyone just falls into line.
Yeah, an authoritative, prissy source.
And I change the industry for the better.
Maybe. I just always try to reword it because
just
I start
comprise.
To question myself.
Because you said this yourself, Susanna. Just avoid comprise. Just avoid the word. Just get out of the argument altogether and stop using comprise.
Do you have an in-house style guide, by the way, for these kinds of things?
Yeah, I based it on the AP style guide, although some people, you know, whether it's AP or Chicago style, mm-hmm. that is basically what I use. Although with social media and everything, I'm kind of being forced away, you know, from the norms sometimes just because of spacing issues. You know, if it's a short blog post or social media, even spelling out acronyms. I mean, most of our product names are so long, you know, we've just resorted to using acronyms and things like that that we hope people in the industry just inherently know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah, there's a lot of grammatical norms that, of course, go out the window now as I move to a paradigm of digital and social media where everything has to be so short and the average reading time is like 25 seconds on a blog, you know.
Right.
So it's a constant battle since I'm, you know, I'm almost 50 now and I'm very well entrenched. I used to carry that AP style guide like a Bible.
Yeah.
And now I have to kind of let it go sometimes.
So. You have to choose your battles, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, for this one, I think you gave yourself the solution. If they insist on using comprise, just go with constitute or compose, composed of or constituted of, and just move on and just sideline that word from here on out. Put it on a brass plaque and never use it again.
Right. Yeah, and it is. It's something you do see a lot in the tech world and out of Silicon Valley. A lot of the companies use it a lot.
People reach for it because it feels a little fancy, and mm-hmm. and you'll often find that in the writing of people who are trying to glitz up their so-so ideas.
Right.
And so maybe use it as a signal that you need to pay more attention to their content too.
Yeah, but it's just one of those words where somebody is going to have a problem with it.
Yeah, that's true as well. Yeah. Whether you get it right or wrong, somebody's going to have difficulty with it.
Yeah.
Hey, Susanna. Yeah, I appreciate your help on this. And I'll stick with what you recommended then to try and make my life easier.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Thanks for your call. Take care now.
Bye, Susanna.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here's another cool term from that book, Home Ground, about words for features of the landscape, singing sand.
This is familiar to me.
Is it?
But perhaps it's from reading Dune. I don't know.
Or perhaps it's from watching a National Geographic documentary. I didn't know this, but apparently sand dunes can make this sort of roaring noise.
Really?
Yeah, I watched a whole segment of a National Geographic.
Singing sand.
There's something about the way that it vibrates that produces this sound. Is sometimes it's a big booming sound, mm-hmm. but then there's like barking sand in Hawaii where you step in sand and you kind of move your feet and mm-hmm. it kind of makes this little yip, yip, yip mm-hmm. sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's singing sand and barking sand.
Barking sand. How about that? Talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hi, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Therese, and I'm calling from Juneau, Alaska.
Hi, Therese. Welcome.
What can we do for you?
Well, when I moved to Alaska like 35 years ago, I moved to a small community, Petersburg, in Southeast. And it was a summer place used by the Tlingit people, got settled by Norwegian people, and it was a strong fishing community. And so my question is, like, I would go down the street and you'd hear, you go nulabocking, or, I got corked on the last bottle of milk, or didn't talk, or, you know, there was just this mixture of, you know, Norwegian and English and sometimes native words and fishing terms. And I wondered if there was an overall term for, you know, when that occurs in a community. I mean, I know it's not the only community in the world that happens, but I'm just kind of wondering if there's a term for it.
Yeah, but I've got to ask you, can you explain all the things that you said? What was the first thing that you said before? You said about being corked?
Oh, corked. It's a fishing term. It comes out of the gill netters, and they set drift gill nets, and the top line of the net is a cork line, and the bottom is a lead line that holds so the net stays open, and it drifts with the current.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of like a pattern that they use, you know, one guy will set and then it'll drift for a little bit. And then when there's enough space, another net will be set and, by a different fisherman. And sometimes somebody takes cuts and, they set too close to somebody. So they call it getting corked. That's one of the terms.
So they're taking somebody else's catch more or less.
Well, they're kind of interfering with somebody's ability to get a good catch, you know.
Gotcha.
That's my understanding of it. I trolled, so I don't know exactly how they set their nets, but I do know that that was the process.
And you said something, you were talking about walking down the street and you'll hear something, and then you said something before court.
Oh, yulebocking?
Yeah, what's that?
Yulebocking is a Christmas celebration. They do it Christmas Eve, and in Norway, you would have gone from farm to farm, and people would leave food out on their table, and in Petersburg, they go business to business, and it's a very social thing. Everybody goes, kids, dogs, grandparents, it doesn't matter. And traditionally, you eat Norwegian foods. might have an adult beverage along the way. You know, so it's very fun.
So we're talking Norwegian and English and Klingit and fishing argo and other things, all kind of used on a daily basis.
Rolled into one.
Yeah. Yeah, yep. So this does happen around the world, as you guessed. Anytime you've got a bunch of different people with a common interest living in the same locations, you do get an interchange of words. And it's contact language is what it is. And if it happens long enough, then you can get a permanent transfer and things can develop. One of the things that can happen is you can get a trade language. And there have been some known in the Pacific Northwest, as a matter of fact, where a language developed that was used amongst people who traded. And now it was only used for trade, where they would come together for agricultural products and fish products and different kinds of things and use it. Just as long as they were doing commerce together, as long as they were doing business, but it wasn't something they used on a day-to-day basis in their homes. Then you can also get pidgins, if it happens long enough, where two or more languages can combine different features, grammatical features and lexical features, and develop something more sophisticated with rules and that can be passed along from parents to children, and it can become an actual language. And these can survive generations and be something that can be passed through time and history and be cataloged and join the larger human family of languages.
And that's spelled P-I-D-G-I-N.
That's right. Pidgin. Not like the bird.
Yeah.
Is that they refer to that in Hawaii sometimes?
That's right. That is there is a Hawaiian pidgin, which is a mix of the original Hawaiian language and English.
Well, I was just curious because I mean, that was one of the things that first struck me as a young, you know, just out of college going there and hearing this and like, well, going, wow, you know, it's kind of interesting. I came from New England and we have our own little set of weird words too, but I just kind of wondered how that came about and how it was referred to.
Yeah, but languages and contact always, they always leave a little bit of each other on each other. And it works both ways. Even the a small language surrounded by a larger language will leave a little something behind. It always happens. If there's a sufficient length of time, just a little bit around. Sometimes it's just food words. Sometimes it's commerce words. Sometimes it's family terms. But there's just a little something left behind.
I thought it enriched the community.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I think it does. And it leaves a flavor. Yeah. I have to say, I appreciate your field report. I feel like you are a field worker for us, and you have delivered a solid field report from Alaska.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I could help.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Therese.
And, oh, thank you.
This was Skookum.
Yes, it is. It's Skookum, and that's right. So, have a great day.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, what are the words and phrases and idioms that flavor your part of the world? Let us know, 877-929-9673, or email words@waywardradio.org. A Texan friend of mine uses the expression happy as a boarding house pup. And apparently a lot of Texans use this term. And I thought, why would a pup at a boarding house be happy?
I think I've heard about this. It's because the food is known to be bad. And so you, on the sly, you scrape it off so the dog can eat it under the table.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense. I was just picturing like a bed and breakfast, you know, where the dog is so happy to see everybody and everybody's missing their dogs back home. So they're giving the dog lots of attention.
No, it's
that makes a lot more sense.
The board comes with the room and they give you the bare minimum food and it's usually terrible.
That makes so much more sense. I'm so glad I mentioned that to you. Happy as a boarding house pup.
The dog doesn't care. Not as much as the humans do.
877-929-9673.
Support for Away With Words comes from Jack and Caroline Raymond, proud sponsors of Wayward Inc., the nonprofit that produces and distributes this program. You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. I was going through one of our favorite reference works, the Dictionary of American Regional English, and I realized that there are an awful lot of regional terms that involve the word cat.
Cat.
And cats.
C-A-T, yeah. Cat.
C-A-T. For example, do you know what cat beer is?
I hesitate to guess, given how often cats vomit. At least they have
I hadn't thought about that.
They have the grace on the dogs not to re-consume it.
It has nothing to do with...
Oh, I don't know. What's cat beer?
Cat beer is a term that you hear in the north, at least in Minnesota and in Vermont, that means milk.
Oh, how about that?
Cat beer.
Cat beer.
Yeah. What about cat hair?
It's not the cat hair, cat hair. It's something else.
No.
Would this be, I don't know, cat hair?
Like you might say of somebody, oh, he's certainly got the cat hair.
Whiskers on your face from not shaving? I don't know.
Money.
That's money? I don't.
They had citations from Oklahoma and Ohio.
Cat hair. To have the cat hairs to have money. Okay.
Yeah. How about that?
Sure.
And cat ice is another one I really liked.
Cat ice? Not cat eyes?
No, not cat eyes.
Who's that? What's that?
Cat ice is really, really thin ice. It's either because, here's one citation from Wisconsin that says, cat ice forms in depressions in fields, edges of pools, just like glass. It looks like the eye of a cat with bubbles in the ice, or a cat would break it stepping on it.
Oh, I know that kind of ice.
Yeah, I know that. And one more, cat face.
Oh, sure. I know that one. Yeah. We have terms for that. We have citations for that on our website.
Oh, okay.
So these are fruits, vegetables, especially tomatoes, where they kind of grow with some weird splits in the side, like the way the cat's mouth is shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the way that a tomato looks when you pull it off the vine, you know, that part where it connected to the vine.
Well, it looks like the triangular shape of a cat's face.
Yeah. There are actually a couple of other definitions for cat face. One is a scar or knot on a tree.
Oh, yeah.
But the one that I really like is the one that's used largely in the African-American community in the South. And it means a wrinkle or pucker in clothing when ironed too dry.
Oh.
In fact, Maya Angelou wrote in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, I had to iron 7 starched shirts and not leave a cat's face anywhere.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah.
I didn't know that one.
I know. So many picturesque terms involving cats.
This is A Way with Words. We talk about language. We welcome your calls, your emails, and your tweets. 877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org or talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
I've been reading the book The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. This is the marvelous book about the Great Migration of African Americans from the Jim Crow South and beyond up north. One of the expressions that I'd never come across before was, you must be smelling yourself.
Oh, yes, of course.
Which is what you say of somebody who's conceited.
Right, they have a high opinion of themselves. Yeah,
you must be smelling yourself. It is a marvelous history.
I have read some of that myself, but it's been a number of years.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. The book, again, is...
The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson.
877-929-9673.
Hi there. You have a way with words.
Hi, this is Andres from San Diego, California.
Andres, welcome.
So my question is, where did the term pokey come from? And pokey is in when people refer to like a prison or a jail, you know, people say like, oh, I was in the pokey for a couple nights.
Where'd you run across it?
So actually, it's funny. I was listening to this guy that I follow on the internet. He used to be a bank robber in the 80s. And I don't hear many people say the term pokey anymore. I used to hear it when I was younger, with my uncles and stuff like that. But he referred to jail as pokey, and it kind of just brought back memories. I was like, I wonder where that came from.
There's a little bit of mystery in it, like so many words. We don't know the full story, but it probably goes back to a word known as pogie, which is maybe familiar to you, and I'll get into that in a little bit, which meant a workhouse or a poorhouse. Those two words might not be very well known these days. A workhouse was a prison where you worked as part of your sentence. You did manual labor, usually. And a poorhouse was a similar place, where you worked off a debt. Or maybe it used to be common, if you owed money and couldn't pay it, you were imprisoned. Now, this is not allowed anymore, but at the time it was. And those were known as pogies as well. That word, in turn, we're not really sure where it comes from. But there's another word that you may know, which is the adjective pokey, which is spelled without the E, P-O-K-Y, which means small or cramped, and it may be related to that. And so the idea is that a pokey could just be a small or cramped space. And pokey and pogey, you can hear they sound very much alike. And there's a lot of interplay between these two words. The pokey for jail with the K first appears in print in the early 1900s, but pogey, referring to a small cramped space, appears in the early or in the late 1800s. There's a lot of back and forth, a lot of different spellings for these, a lot of oral transmission. But even now, you will hear pokey and pogey both being used to refer to prison in prison slang and prison argo and different kinds of like the glossaries in the back of these books that people write about their time in the joint and that sort of thing. And there's a one particular expression that sometimes is kind of unsavory, pogey bait. You'll hear sometimes it's used to talk about anything or anyone that might lead someone to commit a crime, especially a sexual one. So, in other words, jailbait. So, pogey bait. Yeah, jailbait. So, that is the same word. In pogey bait is the same word as pokey or pogey to mean a jail.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so that's the most that we know about it.
Well, thank you guys very much for clarifying that.
Yeah, sure. No
thanks
problem.
For calling.
Thanks for calling. Take care.
All right. Thank you guys. Have
Bye-bye.
A great day.
877-929-9673. Here's another cat word from the Dictionary of American Regional English, kitten ball. It's all one word, kitten ball.
Okay, so it's an ordinary phrase, but because you're presenting it this way, it must mean something not ordinary.
Yeah.
Plant related?
Nope.
I have no idea.
It's an early name for softball.
Softball.
Yeah. According to Paul Dixon's Baseball Dictionary, it was introduced in Minneapolis by a fire company as a form of exercise. And the first team took the name Kittens as their nickname.
Oh, okay.
And set up a little diamond next to the station. So it's kind of an informal term for softball and heard in places like Minnesota and Iowa.
Kitten ball,
kitten
instead
ball.
Of, as opposed to maybe hard ball, so it's suggesting the softness of the sport versus the, okay.
Yeah, go kittens.
Go kittens.
877-929-9673. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, it's going well. Who are you and where are you calling from?
So this is Omar, and I'm calling from Wilmington, North Carolina.
Ah, from Wilmington, there on the coast, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, well, great. What can we talk with you about?
Sure. So a little backstory. I was born and raised in Pakistan, and I grew up playing a very popular sport over there called cricket.
Sure.
And oftentimes, I would hear the TV commentators talk about the cricket team captain as the skipper. And I was curious if the term skipper is used for captains of other sports or if it's even used outside the context of sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so skipper for the team captain in cricket, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's incredibly common. You'll find it in curling sometimes, or bowling or bowls, sometimes even in cycling. It comes from, of course, naval usage or seafaring usage. And even in more informal context, just some skipper, anybody in charge of a bus sometimes or any kind of public transit is some just jokingly or in a friendly way, sometimes called the skipper, or even abbreviated to skip. Did you ever call your team captain just skip?
Not really, but generally I would hear them, the commentators talk about, oh, the skipper is out on the field for the coin toss.
Yeah.
And generally it was the Australian cricket team. Mm-hmm. And they would be referring to their captain as the skipper.
Okay. Yeah, so it comes directly from the skipper of a ship. And the word skipper itself comes from the word ship. And it basically means the person who conducts a ship, the person who makes the ship go where the ship needs to go. It's kind of a borrowed usage, the person in charge of conducting this whole enterprise and making it go and do what it needs to do. So, yeah, it's
okay, that's makes sense.
Sometimes even in American baseball, the manager of a team is called the skipper or the skip.
Hmm.
Okay, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not just cricket. But so you're saying in Pakistan, it's less likely to call the captain of the team, the skipper, more likely in Australian cricket?
Yeah, the few times that I do recall it, I would hear the commentators talk about the captains on out on the field.
Uh-huh.
And generally it was the Australian commentators or the Australian cricket team referring to their captain as the skipper.
Okay. How's the Pakistan team doing this year?
Not that great, no.
I'm sorry to hear that. All right. Thanks for your call, Omar. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you've got a question about the language of sports in your country, talk to us. 877-929-9673 or email words@waywardradio.org.
Another word from home ground is segi, T-S-E-G-I.
Don't know much about that.
Yeah.
Obviously not an English word.
Correct. It comes from Navajo and basically means rock canyon. And it's also the source, I was surprised to learn, of the name Canyon de Chelly, which is one of my favorite places on the planet in Arizona. Canyon de Chelly, which is a French corruption of segi.
Oh, how about that? So it just means canyon. That's
yeah.
It. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Nice.
877-929-9673.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Jason. I'm calling from De Pere, Wisconsin.
Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. Well, we had an experience the other night, and my wife and I knew immediately that we needed to call you because we needed some expert advice.
Oh.
We have second-grade twins, and they were practicing their spelling lists for the week. The topic was contractions. And as they were reading the list back and forth from one to the other, they spelled the word thistle as in the contraction for this will. And I immediately took the list away from them and said, you guys, stop making up words. We need to actually practice here. And they showed me the list, and sure enough, thistle appeared on their list. My wife and I talked about it, and I couldn't come up with anything that seemed like appropriate usage to me. And so I thought, we better throw this one to you and get the expert advice. Is this whole floppy language, or can they use it in writing?
So T-H-I-S apostrophe L-L, thistle.
That is it.
A contraction for this will.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your major objection to it?
Well, we tried to think of, you know, writing a paper, and the kids are going to write something, and they're going to say, this will be the answer. You know, like I said, we could come up with, the American Pie song, you know, this will be the day that I die.
Yeah.
But I felt like anything goes in music, but spelling thistle as a contraction, it just didn't make sense to either of us as an appropriate word for them to be learning.
What an interesting question. Were there any other outliers like that? Like that'll?
No, I didn't see that'll.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's my main argument with it was, there wasn't any other outliers. Everything else seemed like common usage words. And I know this is a national spelling list they use at different schools, and so I was just surprised to see that word appear.
Oh, it is a national list? Because I was going to ask if it was possibly pulled from readings that they're doing in class.
Mm.
Like, did it come from books or chapters or other things that they're reading?
Well, oddly enough, I had a discussion about it with their teacher, because we were just kind of bantering about it. And she said, boy, I hope that wasn't something I tossed in there. And she went back to the list and said, no, this is provided as, you know, from the source material that they use and that they're teaching at, you know, multiple schools, I'm sure, across the country.
How about that?
Huh. So the teacher started backpedaling?
She was nervous if it was a word. She said, I sure hope that's not a Mrs. V word. And I said, well, let's look. And she said, no, it's definitely on the list.
Well, it's an allowed contraction. There's nothing morphologically wrong with it. It's a perfectly legitimate contraction in English. Certainly, you can find zillions and zillions of use of it. It's not a common contraction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, compared to the other contractions, it's a sound formation in English, and it's perfectly well-formed.
Mm-hmm. And I think Grant raised a good point, which is that they may well be encountering it in books,
yeah,
or other things that they're reading, thistle, and it would be useful to know. But I can hear your point as well, that you might not want to see that in a paper.
Yeah, and if we were to look at the most common, say, top million words in English, I'm not even sure that would be in there. I mean, you would encounter sheel or heel or wheel, you know, we will, mm-hmm, she will, he will. long before you would encounter thistle.
It had to be somebody's favorite word that they included it on the list.
Maybe, or maybe somebody who had homophones on the brain and they were thinking of the word thistle, T-H-I-S-T-L-E.
Well, that was my first thought, was we're doing contractions. Don't be messing around with thistle.
Yeah, yeah.
thistle.
Ouch. So, Jason, did your daughters have any input on this?
You know, they just thought that I was being goofy, that I was so worked up about, you know, a spelling word. Dad, it's on the list. Of course we have to learn to spell it. You know, just they kind of thought I was being silly.
Yeah. There's no harm in learning it. I don't know that there's a lot of value. It's interesting. It could easily, though, be a nice jumping off point, and I'd be interested to hear from the teacher on this. If you have thistle on the list, it does give you a jumping point for all the other apostrophe LL contractions. So you just use that word to talk about all the other contractions that can be formed in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it isn't a standalone word. We can then talk about wheel and sheel and heel and da 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 and all the other words that are formed with will as a contracted form.
Yeah, it's weird. I think of that'll be $5.95, and I don't think about that.
That would be far more common, right?
Yeah.
That'll be far more common choice than this'll.
Uh-huh. Or those'll.
those'll.
Or these'll.
Maybe.
Well, that's what I'm worried about, those'll and these'll.
They sound so weird standalone, but as part of a sentence, they sound normal.
Well, I'd be real curious to know what other parents of students in your classroom or other parents who are listening might have to say.
Maybe,
about
but
that.
I just want to reassure you, Jason, that no harm is being done here.
All right, I'm going to have to accept it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and your daughters are going to have to admit that Dad's maybe not quite so goofy.
I better correct you that it's a daughter and a son, or they'll be really mad at me.
Oh.
All right.
You have to know twins come in all forms.
Yes, absolutely they do. We'll tell your children we said hello and congratulate them on having a father who cares and pays attention to their schoolwork.
Thank you so much, you guys. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Alrighty.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care now. Bye-bye. 877-929-9673. Email words@waywardradio.org.
Here's a cool Latin word, latibulum. It means a hiding place or a den of animals, a refuge. And latibulum comes from the same word that gives us latent, you know, something that's kind of hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I got excited about this word was because it seems like so many times when I find a cool Latin word like that, you can also find in the 17th and 18th century that people have adopted it into English. And the word is latibulate.
Oh, so they did, but
yeah,
it just didn't catch on.
It didn't catch, you know, it's obsolete now. But latibulate, according to a 1623 dictionary, means privily to hide oneself in a corner.
Privily to hide oneself in the corner.
Yeah, I'm going to go to that party, but I'm going to latibulate.
Fantastic.
877-929-9673. Thanks to senior producer Stephanie Levine, director Colin Tedeschi, editor Tim Felton, and production assistant Caitlin O'Connell.
You can send us a message, subscribe to the podcast, get the newsletter, or catch up on hundreds of past episodes at waywardradio.org.
Our toll-free line is always open in the U.S. and Canada, 877-929-9673. Or send us your thoughts to words@waywardradio.org.
Away with Words is an independent production of Wayward Inc., a nonprofit supported by listeners and organizations who are changing the way the world talks about language.
We're coming to you from the Recording Arts Center at Studio West in San Diego, California.
Thanks for listening. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
It's just after 6 o'clock, which means it's time for the penguin on top of your TV set to explode. If you can find your radio amongst the penguin dust, tune in to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
You took the first step and quit smoking, but even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know about a new low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save your life. You took the first step, now take the next. Visit SaveByTheScan.org for a simple quiz to see if you're eligible and talk to your doctor about screening. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Oh, and yet we all of us spend all our days saying to each other the same things time after weary time. I love you, don't go in there, get out, you have no right to say that. Stop it, why should I? That hurt, help, Marjorie is dead.
So we should call the library. No, no, WRCT Pittsburgh, 412-621-9728.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, even as the withdrawal of U.S. ground troops from Afghanistan is ongoing, corporate media are weaving tales. Virtually every media assessment focuses on losses to U.S. military and erases the tens of thousands of Afghan civilians killed in the 20-year occupation. Many stories strongly suggest that the whole thing was driven by a not-at-all opportunistic desire to free Afghan women, though reality tells us that TV news aired more segments that mentioned women's rights in the same sentence as Afghanistan in the last 7 days than in the previous 7 years. A Washington Post editorial goes so far as to assert that a small U.S. and allied military presence could have not only defeated the Taliban and nurtured a fledgling civil society, but could have done so in a way that, quote, not only would have been affordable, but also could have paid for itself, close quote. Anyone born before last week can see U.S. news media lying about history as it's happening. But fast forward to 10, 20 years from now, and these media stories will have hardened into narrative, into the unspoken given presented as context for the latest thing. That's the power of history as told, a power well understood by James Lowen, the historian and author who died August 19th at the age of 79. Some U.S. media are now lauding Jim Lowen, but without ceasing to generate the very sort of misty misinformation he fought against. Counterspin spoke with James Lowen in July of 2015. We're going to listen again to that conversation today. That's coming up, but first, a brief look back at some recent press. Floods, fires, ice caps melting, hurricanes, all attest to the violence of human-caused climate disruption. It's undeniable and undeniably fatal. And the only question for historians will not be what mysterious factors prevented humans from responding, but what political structures prevented the humans that wanted to respond meaningfully from doing so. When those books are written, at least a chapter will be devoted to cases like that of Jessica Reznicek, the activist now facing 8 years in prison for damaging equipment at the Dakota Access Pipeline in Iowa. In 2016, Reznicek, with fellow activist Ruby Montoya, set fire to heavy machinery, delaying construction for weeks on the pipeline that would move a 500,000 barrels of crude oil a day under the Missouri River and the lake that is the reservoir that provides the primary water source for the Standing Rock Reservation. Listeners will know of longstanding protests against the threats pipelines like Dakota Access present for water, land, and communities, as well as the global climate. The pipeline violates indigenous sovereignty and treaty rights.